Take the Money and Run is the first film written and directed by Woody Allen, first released in 1969. Woody Allen stars as Virgil Starkwell, a bank robber and a petty criminal. Told as a mockumentary, we learn about his childhood, his first crimes, his arrests, his getaway, and his eventual fate. What it really is, though, is a chance for Woody Allen to create sketch after sketch of absurdist humour. Take the Money and Run is a highly regarded comedy, the first of a few purely comedic films that Allen would make, sometimes referred to, I know, as his early funny ones, before heading into more interesting ground. So welcome to the Woody Allen Pages podcast. This week, we look at 1969's Take the Money and Run, how it was conceived, how it was made, how after all these years it's still quite funny, and how it all started. Spoilers are everywhere, so watch the film and then come back.
Oh, I see. This is a holdup.
Yes.
May I see your gun?
Woody Allen always wanted to work in film, but the road there was a bit tipsy-turvy. It took him a little while to start being a director. And it's worth looking at that journey because it informs how he approached his first film, and then every film since. Allen used his comedy career to get into Hollywood. There's no doubt about it, and lots of comedians do the same thing. He used his contacts and his managers to hustle until he got on TV, writing some jokes and sketches and worked his way up. His first film credit was as a writer for What's New Pussycat. The film was a typical romantic farce of the period, the mid-60s. It's the story of a playboy who kind of just goes on sexual misadventures. The finished film makes the Austin Powers series look like documentaries. The new Hollywood revolution hadn't happened yet, and that was all set to kill off films such as this. What's New Pussycat was the brainchild of Warren Beatty, and the producers wanted someone to write jokes. In comes Woody Allen. Because he had some performance experience in stand-up and TV, he asked to be in the film as well. The film had no clear structure or vision, so the producers said, why the hell not? The story goes that Allen wrote a bigger and bigger part for himself as the revisions wore on. Warren Beatty threatened to quit, and the producers let him. Peter O'Toole took the lead role instead. The production of the film was a mess, and the end result was also a mess. It's a barely coherent series of sketches that has some fun moments, but the tone of it is so full of itself. For Woody, the whole experience was a letdown. He saw, firsthand, how a film can be so bad. Allen wrote the script, and then he'd turn up on set to act, but he missed the creative decisions in between, from the director, producers, and the production team, and he saw how his good script became a bad film. Basically, on What's New Pussycat, he learnt what not to do.
Did you find a job?
Yeah, I got something at the striptease. I helped the girls dress and undress.
Nice job.
20 francs a week.
Not very much.
It's all I can afford.
Allen took control of his next film project, What's Up Tiger Lily. But this wasn't so much a film as a mixtape. Allen took two Japanese comedy spy films, which were a spoof of James Bond, and cut them into a new story and dubbed the film with new jokes. Allen, his friend and co-writer Mickey Rose, and his wife Louise Lasser did all the voices. But that control didn't last. The film was edited and expanded later without Allen's knowledge. For no reason whatsoever, the 60s rock band The Lovin' Spoonful were added, performing a couple of songs. Allen realised that being a director didn't mean much either. His work can still get mangled. Allen's acting turn in the haphazard James Bond comedy Casino Royale was similar. Allen wasn't a writer on that 1967 film, but it's been suggested he did write some of the jokes. But either way, he learnt again that he didn't like the way these films were made. So he realised the most important thing was that elusive creative control and final say, and he was even willing to take a pay cut to get it. And when he found a film company willing to give him that creative control, he took it and ran.
I don't know, when it comes to women in prison, I remember the psychiatrist asked me if I had a girl, and I said no. And he said, well, do I think that sex is dirty? And he said it is if you're doing it right.
As much as Allen was pushing for full creative control, Take the Money and Run was not the work of a single vision. The film, and a lot of Allen's work in the 60s, was co-written with Mickey Rose. Rose was one of Allen's best friends from high school and had written or co-written some of Allen's stand-up routines. Most notably, he had a hand in The Moose. As I mentioned, he worked on Tiger Lily and he would also work with Allen again on Bananas. Mickey appears in the film. He's apparently one of the prison rock breakers. I've watched it several times to try and find Mickey, but no one stands out as clearly looking like the couple of blurry photos of Mickey Rose that exist online. He was on set, but maybe we only see his back or something in the end. But Alan and Rose didn't come up with a traditional start-to-finish script. The making of Take the Money and Run was much more chaotic than that. Alan and Rose toyed with other ideas, but ultimately they landed on making a film about the life of a criminal named Virgil Starkwell. But really, that's just a premise, an empty plate that they could serve up all sorts of jokes. If there is a story, then it's this. Virgil Starkwell is a low-level criminal. He is arrested for a petty robbery and spends some time in prison. When he gets out, he returns to a life of crime, snatching handbags and robbing a pet shop. But he meets Louise, a beautiful woman, and he falls in love. They start a relationship, but he gets himself arrested after a bank robbery. Virgil escapes again, this time on the run with Louise. He tries to go straight, but it doesn't last and returns to crime. Virgil plans one big bank heist to solve all his problems, but he is caught once again and put to work in a chain gang. Virgil manages to escape again, but ultimately, again, returns to crime. We leave Virgil in prison, probably where he belongs.
Virgil, now that you're caught and are facing a very long prison sentence, do you have any regrets about choosing a life of crime?
I think that crime definitely pays, and that, it's a great job. The hours are good, and you're your own boss, and you travel a lot, and you get to meet interesting people, and I just think it's a good job in general.
The jokes do hang off a structure, the so-called mockumentary. Take the Money and Run is credited as one of the first mockumentaries, and certainly one of the first biggish budget American ones. Alan and Rose makes fun of the pompousness of the format. So many times the jokes come from the documentary being played straight, but something odd and funny happening. It's dumb things being taken seriously that fuels the humour. Take Virgil's parents. They are essentially playing it pretty straight as bickering parents. Nothing inherently funny about it, and they kind of aren't trying to be. But to hide their identities, they're wearing disguises, we are told, and they have chosen Groucho Marx glasses. Why? It doesn't matter.
In an effort to shed some light on this period of his life, we spoke with his father and mother. They are ashamed of their son's criminal record and so wear disguises.
Sure, he was a good boy.
Oh, come on. If he was a good boy, why are we wearing these? He's rotten. He's a gangster. That's what he is. This is what he
How
is.
How can you say that? He was so bright.
Taking dumb things seriously is also in Virgil's crimes. They are usually dumb, like escaping prison with a gun made of soap, or being on the run whilst tied to a chain gang, or trying to play the cello in a marching band. It's a kind of dumb funny made funnier by the serious-sounding narrator. But what the mockumentary does more than anything else is give us that slight bit of structure. It's just a little bit more than a series of sketches. We know it's going to be a life story of sorts, and we do, roughly, go chronologically. But even this is a bit of a gag. It's a cliché of a life story documentary.
On December 1st, 1935, Mrs. William Starkwell, the wife of a New Jersey handyman, gives birth to her first and only child. It is a boy, and they name it Virgil. He is an exceptionally cute baby with a sweet disposition. Before he is 25 years old, he will be wanted by police in 6 states for assault, armed robbery, and illegal possession of a wart.
Like most documentaries, we start with Virgil as a child. We talk to his parents, teachers, or probation officers who knew him, and we go through family photos and stock footage. It's exactly what this kind of documentary would do. Those photos of young Virgil are actually photos of young Alan. Virgil also shares the same birth date as Alan. Alan also uses actual stock footage and photos from the time. Some of the jokes actually come from that stock footage, and it builds off what Alan did with What's Up Tiger Lily, where he just put gags above existing film. The gag about the grandfather being hit in the head and thinking he's the Kaiser clearly comes from the fact that Alan could get the footage. It wasn't like Alan had the joke and sourced the footage, and I assume that footage came cheap, if not free. And it's worth noting that using stock footage and access to stock footage archives was still relatively new at this time. And of course, the language of stock footage is baked into the documentary format.
Then tragedy strikes. At a Washington Senators game, Virgil's grandfather is struck in the head by a foul ball. The blow causes permanent injury to his mind, and he becomes convinced he is Kaiser Wilhelm. Here are some rare photos of him with other patients on the sanitarium grounds.
After we meet Virgil, we see a few of his crimes. And making fun of a lot of those crime tropes makes up a lot of the film. Some of the humour plays with the image of the glorified criminals that loomed in popular culture at the time. People like bank robbers Bonnie and Clyde, but probably more Bonnie and Clyde the film from 1967. Another popular recent film was Cool Hand Luke, the prison film starring Paul Newman. But Alan, the film fan, was drawing on lots of references as well. But the 60s was a rich time for criminals on screen. Not that Alan and Rose have anything deep to say about criminals or crime. They weren't saying a thing about what drives people to crime or the cycle of crime or anything like that. It's just a basis for jokes. Maybe someone could have written a script about this poor guy who just can't stop being a loser with actual character and emotion. But no, they were just being smartasses.
This was really a desperate time in my life. You know, we had no money. I tried mugging old ladies, but I got hit in the groin with a crutch.
There's a lot of fun to be mined here, though. I love the prison escape with the hostage, but they can't hear each other. Of course, the gub sequence, or the soap gun. There's so many ideas. A lot of the comedy is physical comedy. Alan fights with the laundry folding machine like Chaplin does with machinery in modern times. There's a pool hall scene that is just Alan being silly with music playing over it. No dialogue at all. I can't imagine there was an actual script for this. Alan set up the scene and just improvised physical comedy and cut it together.
Under constant economic pressure, Virgil turns to the local pool hall as a means of making a living. I'm going to be a pool hustler, he tells his friends.
However, the crime stuff gets repetitive. Virgil does 3 stints in prison. He robs at least 3 banks. After a while, we need something to happen to this guy. And what happens is Louise. Let's face it, Louise is not a character, more a plot device. She goes from a mysterious beauty in the park who stutters to a cliched housewife who can't cook to being a willing accomplice. Just whatever the sketch at the time is asking of her. The scene where Virgil and Louise meet could just be stock footage. It's all about the voiceover. Alan and Rose were experienced stand-up and joke writers. The humour is all in the writing. What happens on screen is just colour and outlines.
But she was so sweet. We just walked in the park and I was so touched by her that, I don't know, after 15 minutes I wanted to marry her. And after a half hour I completely gave up the idea of snatching her purse.
In fact, it almost seems like in a couple of scenes, there was dialogue between Virgil and Louise. Like at the restaurant or their nighttime walk, where they are clearly speaking and probably doing dialogue that Alan came up with. But Alan chooses instead to play romantic music and do voiceover gags. These moments with Virgil and Louise are really the only place where the film slows down from its joke rate. It continues when Virgil and Louise's relationship grows. The film becomes less about crime and more awkward relationship humour.
And here I'm lying through my teeth. I mean, I can't tell Louise that I was in jail and that I rob and steal and never did an honest day's work in my life, because, you know, a lot of people hold those things against you.
The film also becomes slightly less of a mockumentary. There's a couple of lines to refer to some of these scenes as being captured on home footage, but that's obviously nonsense. It looks like a traditionally shot sketch. The reality of this film changes a fair bit. After we meet Louise, the film is back to sketch after sketch. The bad thing is that these sketches could almost come in any order, and there's not a feeling of story and nothing we are building up to. That pool horse scene, for example, really could be placed anywhere in the film. Most of the jokes don't escalate, with the exception of the gub joke and the glasses stomping joke. There's no big heist at the end.
The prison has not been built that can hold me, Virgil tells another inmate, and I'll get out of this one if it means spending my entire life here.
The chain gang sequence is arguably the biggest sequence. There's a lot of people in it, and it feels like a culmination of sorts. The gang travels to different locations, and there's a bit of a story. There's a rich history of chain gang films, most notably one called I Am a Fugitive in a Chain Gang. But after that, we go back to another series of heists. The film ends with Virgil captured by accident by an old friend who is a cop. The lead up to it is just a few talking heads. That ending feels rushed.
Well, I didn't hear you.
Well, look, it's been great
speaking to you, really.
Oh, it's so nice to see you, Virgil.
Yeah, you too. Take it easy. Yeah. Let me see you again.
Yeah, best of luck to
you. Okay.
Virgil, I just realized.
Yeah.
I'm a cop.
No kidding.
It's worth noting that Alan originally was building to something. Virgil was supposed to die in a hail of bullets, and the scene was shot. Production photos exist. but it was removed when Alan decided to make it a much lighter comedy. It suggests that Alan had a bit more of an ending and a bit more of a story that he was originally aiming for. Alas, without it, the film badly lacks structure. But it makes up for it in jokes. Over and over, there is just a joyful playfulness to the film. It's always trying to make you laugh. I love the really dumb joke of people taking off Virgil's glasses and stomping on them. It's a sequence with a young Virgil as a kid being bullied, and then Virgil is attacked playing cello as an adult and it happens again. A great callback to a joke. But then 20 minutes later, a judge does the same gag. It's very funny. I think the anarchic, silly jokes work best. Like Virgil stealing a plate of glass, or the job interview that turns into a game show. They have almost nothing to do with the story, but that nonsense is funny.
You said before you worked in an office. Did you deal in products or services?
Products.
Is this something found in the home?
No, it's not. It's one down and nine to go.
Is this product edible?
No, I'm afraid it wasn't. I think our time has run out, and I'm sorry to say you haven't guessed my occupation, so I'm going to flip all the cards and tell you exactly what I used to do. I used to manufacture escalator shoes for people who were nauseous in elevator shoes. I'm sorry you...
Of course, there's the one-liners. The film is full of Alan's wit. Alan's own voice fills in sequences that were probably first attempted in silence, and there's a lot of good quotes. A few decades later, the interesting thing is how particularly Woody Allen this film is. So many of his tropes are already in place. Of course, Allen would do mockumentaries again in films like Zelig and Sweet and Lowdown. There's a blackmail plot that can only be solved by murder, such as in Crimes and Misdemeanors or Match Point. There's making fun of interior decorators, insurance salesmen, and stamp collectors. There's the fun of having to deal with difficult directors. There's all that silent comedy that he would do again in films like Sleeper. There's even a long shot with a handheld camera, like the scene where Virgil and Louise fight before he goes to a bank robbery. Alan's worldview was already set. He just needed to learn how to make films.
He didn't always tell the truth. Sometimes he exaggerated the truth. Sometimes he just plain lies.
It might feel dated today, and it might feel slight when you start here for your Woody Allen marathon. But this was 1969. Comedies were kind of like this. But I feel like Alan had wanted to make more of a story. He wanted to not make a 1969 unconnected comedy. But that's not where the film ended up. And the production ended up being more trouble than he was ready for.
At 18, Virgil is lonely and confused. Unable to concentrate in school, he has long since dropped out. He wants nothing more than to belong, if only to a street gang. It is here he thinks he will prove his manhood.
Alan hadn't yet found his filmmaking home in New York. For his first film, he had the option to shoot anywhere he wanted, and he chose San Francisco for a couple of reasons. One, it was on the West Coast where a lot of actors and production crew lived. The other was simply that Alan loved the city. Alan spent a lot of time in San Francisco prior to filming there. He did stand-up in the city, and it was a place where he felt affection for. He loved the countercultural San Fran of the 60s. And of course he would return to film there with Blue Jasmine many decades later. But Alan doesn't make the most of it. People like to set films in San Francisco because it's easy to telegraph the location to the audience. Just show that Golden Gate Bridge to audiences and they know where they are. But Alan doesn't show off San Francisco. A lot of this story could be set in any town USA. It feels like Alan and his team went out of their way to find generic locations. To film, Alan used a cinemobile. It was a relatively new innovation at the time. It was a van with a movie studio inside, essentially. Back in the day, it was still amazing to get all that heavy equipment into one van. You could also sit on top of the van and film. The cinemobile was invented by Fuad Saeed, a cinematographer who worked on TV. He was likely chosen to work on this film because of that cinemobile. But Saeed and Alan didn't get along and was fired shortly into production. But Alan kept the van. Another TV cinematographer, Lester Shaw, was hired instead.
We play the actors, or we needed somebody to be the director.
Gurch, I got the perfect guy.
That cinemobile meant Alan could work at a frantic pace. Alan and his team drove that van around, set up, shot, and kept moving. The team had ideas, and they would just set up somewhere and film it. It meant that possibly for the only time ever, Alan finished the film ahead of schedule and under budget. It speaks to Allen's work ethic that he took that ruthlessly efficient approach. He wanted to desperately finish his first film, but that meant that his locations, framing, and shot choices left a lot to be desired. A lot of scenes were just shot in streets or parking lots or wherever. It's also funny to think of Allen frantically driving around San Francisco, shooting when and where he can. As recently as in Crisis in Six Scenes, at the end of a shooting day, someone asked if he wanted to stay and do another take, and Allen responded that he couldn't let filmmaking take over his life and went home. The documentary style made the amateur, rushed feel work. It's supposed to be a lot of quickly captured footage anyway. Allen could get away with shaky camera work and basic undressed sets. But there are the odd, beautiful shots. A lot of it is in that chain gang segment, where we get that wide open shot of the farmlands and the quarry. There's also some dramatic close-ups, and you can feel the atmosphere.
Because you work in a laundry, you're gonna steal the guard's underwear.
What?
Yes, we've already got some uniforms stashed in a dark room.
I don't understand. If you got the guard's uniforms, what do you need their underwear?
We want to do this as realistically as possible.
Allen would also learn to care less about being on budget and being efficient, and take his time, sometimes to ridiculous degrees. Because no one watches a film and thinks, that wasn't very good, but at least they made it ahead of schedule. And what Allen came back with after principal photography wasn't working anyway. Of the San Francisco locations, the prison scenes are filmed at the famous San Quentin prison. The prisoners were paid a small amount to appear in the film. The production had to be careful in identifying extras compared to the real prisoners. The San Quentin scenes were actually the first days of shooting.
It is here that he mingles with hardened criminals for the first time.
The scene with the marching band is Mission Street, one of San Francisco's main streets. The bank scenes were shot at a real bank and shot during a holiday when Allen and the crew could shoot without disturbing regular bank business. There's some scenes in a park and some street scenes early on, but otherwise it's a lot of indoor stuff. The Talking Heads, Virgil in his apartment, or the one that he shares with Louise. Overall, this isn't a film about great locations.
Mr. Public, have you had any experience working in an office before?
Yes, I have.
What kind of office was it?
Rectangular.
But as much as Allen and his team brought the film in on time and on budget in the production, it was in post-production where things didn't go to plan. Allen's first edit wasn't working, and it wasn't funny. It seems that the initial cut, for good or bad, wasn't as one-dimensionally jokey as the finished film. Allen had tried to mix up some softer and sadder moments that still had jokes, and he had more of a story, including that ending where Virgil dies, but it took the energy out of the film. Ralph Rosenblum was brought in. He was an experienced comedy film editor. He had just worked with Mel Brooks on The Producers. He was tasked with turning the film into a stronger comedy. Rosenblum cut several sequences and taught Allen how to make it funny on film. He encouraged Allen to use different music and more upbeat music in sequences. For example, Allen used sadder, slower music in the scene where he's getting changed for a big date. Allen wanted to play the more subtle humor of this guy getting changed, but the joke comes in the end. But instead, it was all just set up and people didn't realize a payoff was coming.
What genes?
And chromosomes.
What genes? What? Don't talk fancy in front of the man because, you know, you make an impression.
There are all sorts of rather obvious editing tricks used, many of them to get out of scenes. Take the one of Virgil in prison, where he participates in some experiment and turns into a Hasidic Jew. There's no ending to the scene. There's just a rise in the music and then a close-up. The scene ends because the music ends.
We need volunteers for an experiment. The doctors want someone to be inoculated with a new vaccine. It's never been tried on humans before, so we don't know what the side effects may be.
There are those scenes where characters are talking, but we don't hear them, and now it's just music. A lot of those talking scenes took the energy out of the film. Some of the editing is rough, and it's kind of the worst part of the film. It was what Rosenblum and Allen could salvage, and in the end, they went for funny over anything else. It also explains why they changed that ending of Virgil being killed. The editing process on this film set the standard for Allen for several decades, that the edit would be as important as the writing process. And Rosenblum would work with Allen several more times, including on Annie Hall.
And about the camera. Well, back to this thing in which I became known merely because of what happened and I had the camera. I was having breakfast in the morning. I think it was two fried eggs, toast. I don't know whether it was orange juice or grapefruit, but I remember I had a juice. I don't remember what it was. But at that time, it was orange juice, that's right.
there isn't much of a credited cast. It's very much the Woody Allen show. Apart from some flashbacks, he's essentially in every scene. Janet Margolin is the other billed cast member. She had worked a little in theatre, but had been given acclaim for her work in the 1962 film David and Lisa, where she played a young woman with a split personality. She was one of many actresses who auditioned for the role with Allen, who was just knocked out by her beauty and talent. He couldn't believe someone so good would want to appear in his film. Margolin doesn't get much to do beyond just being lovely. She does have to keep a straight face while Allen is being ridiculous, and she does it well. Margolin didn't have the success that some thought she deserved. She appeared in much more TV and films in minor roles, including a part in Ghostbusters 2. She also worked with Allen again, playing one of Allen's wives in Annie Hall. She died in 1993, just aged 50, of cancer.
I think if he had been a successful criminal, he would have felt better. You know, he never made the 10 most wanted list. It's very unfair voting. It's who you know.
The fact the character is named Louise shows that Allen had actually wanted his wife, Louise Lasser, in the role. But the people around Allen felt he needed a more established name in the role, and Allen relented. He made the right choice. Lasser is beautiful, but she's quirky and silly. Margolin is more wistful and mysterious. Lasser, however, is still in the film, being interviewed by Allen in a scene at the end. She's pretty funny in her clearly improvised scene, interviewed by Allen. But it's another scene that really could have been placed anywhere in the film.
Just when I found out that he was a criminal, I just couldn't believe it. I just thought I was going to die, because he was the best cover-up job I've ever seen in my life. I mean, unbelievable acting job. I actually believed that he was an idiot. I mean, I really believed, and I wasn't the only one. Like, everybody thought so. Everyone just thought that he was such a schlemiel, and it turns out he's a criminal.
In fact, many of the talking heads and extras are great. Usually they are cartoons being asked to do one funny thing in one scene. A lot of them never had film credits ever again. Virgil's parents are, as I mentioned, hilarious. They are played by two actors in their most significant screen roles. Henry Leff, who taught acting in San Francisco, and Ethel Sokolow, who sadly passed away a year after this film came out. Like many of the extras, there were locals who didn't really get to be in films because they didn't work in Hollywood. There is a couple of minor character actors here, like the chain gang warden, James Anderson, who was in To Kill a Mockingbird, or Marcel Hilliard, who plays the pompous director Fritz, who was in the Audrey Hepburn film Sabrina. But those were hardly names who would be putting bums on seats. Another small role is Dan Frazier, who would also have small roles in Bananas and many decades later in Deconstructing Harry. He plays a talking head psychologist named Julius Epstein, most likely a nod to the Casablanca screenwriter who had exactly the same name.
Louise's impact on Virgil is discussed here by Dr. Julius Epstein, a one-time prison psychiatrist who recalls Virgil.
Well, Louise meant a great deal to Virgil, from a psychiatric point of view. His love for her was the healthiest thing in his life. It was genuine and clean, not like some patients I know.
The main star is Woody himself. He had appeared in other films, but here he is the top-billed star and has to carry the whole thing. And on the whole, he's pretty good, but he's definitely playing to his strengths. He hasn't got long pieces of dialogue, and no one is given a better role to show him up. The main thing Allen wants to do is be funny. And through his acting, he gets to do all kinds of funny. There's plenty of slapstick. He also gets to be an idiot, like in the chain gang stuff, where he's clearly not the tough guy, and that's the humour. But throughout, he's holding enough charm to get through. It was around this time that the producers of the upcoming film version of Play It Again, Sam wasn't convinced that Allen could play the role on screen. I'm not sure this film convinced him one way or the other that he could do a serious role. But for comedy, at least, he could be a star.
No, all I know is my heart was really pounding, and I felt a funny tingling all over. You know, and I was either in love or I had smallpox.
The film's narrator is Jackson Beck. He was a radio announcer who did many serials, and had his voice used in The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly. He sounds exactly like you'd want him to. His voice adds to the authentic, pompous nature of the documentary, which Allen then undercut. Beck would work with Allen again in Radio Days.
Virgil complains, and he is severely tortured. For several days, he is locked in a sweatbox with an insurance salesman.
The end result of the film doesn't feel like what we've come to know as a Woody Allen film. There's none of the great actors, or those kinetic shots, or the warm colour scheme, or many of the hallmarks that he would later develop. Of course, the music is wrong. The music is lovely, but it's wrong. The score was written by Marvin Hamlisch, one of the most accomplished composers in Hollywood history. He has written songs like The Way We Were and Nobody Does It Better. He's an EGOT, one of a dozen or so people on the planet to win an Emmy, a Grammy, an Oscar, and a Tony. But all that was yet to come. For now, Hamlisch was a talented young composer. He signed on for this film and is almost overflowing with ideas. His score for the opening credits is intricate and tricky. He writes a lovely romantic theme for Virgil and Louise. He does all the things composers are supposed to do. It probably fits for the film, but it's weird to see Woody Allen with such an obvious and distinctive original score. For Allen's part, he didn't do too much collaborating with Hamlisch. He would work with him again on Bananas, but by then, he would realise how much time and money was being spent on music, and he would go to pre-recorded music as his first choice soon enough. And of course, the opening credit sequence is wrong. It's a long sequence of music and Allen walking in the prison. It's not funny, it's not exciting, it's not anything. It's just a pause in the film. Allen never liked it, although he was still a few films away from his distinctive opening credits style.
On July 11th, Virgil and Louise marry. It is a simple ceremony following what he later described as a deeply moving blood test.
All in all, Allen was learning. This was his first film. He would learn that bringing a film in on time and on budget meant nothing. He would learn the importance of editing. He would get better at story. And he would soon pick up important collaborators who would handle cinematography, casting, editing, and more. So much more was to come.
Well, I came up with an idea for a robbery that was so fantastic and so brilliant that when it was over, it was considered a real work of art by all the guys in my cell block.
They must have looked up to you.
Take the Money and Run was released on Palomar Pictures in 1969, a then new small film company that was willing to take a risk on Allen. United Artists, a bigger company that Allen would end up at, were interested too, but were unwilling to give Allen that full creative control that he craved. Palomar were, especially as Allen didn't ask for that much of a budget. The success of this film convinced United Artists to give Allen a multi-film offer with creative control. This would be Allen's only film on Palomar, which means it's always missing from Allen box sets and collections. Palomar had some great films in the late 60s and early 70s, like The Heartbreak Kid and The Taking of Pelham 1-2-3. Down to Woody Allen's name, the film did okay. It was the 23rd highest grossing film of 1969, but most importantly, it showed that Allen's name could sell a film and he was able to at least point the camera and keep it in focus. There were some doubts on him being a big box office draw, but it was enough that United Artists would come along and give him a three-picture deal. That was what he won.
How long are you going to be here?
Oh, well, I estimate in the neighborhood of, what's today, Monday? Mm-hmm. Tuesday, Wednesday, next year, 10 years.
For me, I put Take the Money and Run in with Allen's other early work, like his 60s stand-up and comedy writings. It's pretty much what you would expect from a comedian making the jump to the big screen. The laugh rate and the joke variety is pretty good. Even today, over 50 years later, some of it is still really hilarious. The clothes, the music, and other elements have dated. The film's pacing is dated, but the film is still funny, if you're not put off by older humour in general. I don't think it's a great film. I personally almost never think to put it on. There's no heart to it. There's no excitement or passion. It's just funny. And these days, it's easy to get a lot of funny. What is best is that it feels like a Woody Allen film. It's his silly ideas, his sense of humour, and it's proof of product that all of this works fine on the big screen. Woody Allen would go on to improve almost every part of his filmmaking. He would get better at directing and coming up with great shots and sequences. He would become an incredible writer, coming up with hundreds of characters and stories. Music, editing, costumes, title sequences, all of it would get better. Some of it would get a lot better. It shows a lot of promise. But this film, still, is funny. And I'm not sure Allen makes too many more films that are this funny. Just bonkers, silly joy. Especially outside of the 70s funny stuff, Allen doesn't get much funnier than this. I still laugh out loud at some of the moments, after all these years. And for a comedy, what more needs to be said?
One day he told me he was a gynecologist. He couldn't speak no foreign languages. Who's he kidding?
Here's some fun facts about Take the Money and Run. So, isn't What's Up Tiger Lily Allen's first film? Look, yes, there's a lot of things that could be considered that make Tiger Lily Allen's first film. It was his first full-length work. It was released to cinemas. It is its own DVD. But on the other hand, it's just a bit of an extended sketch. Allen didn't actually write it, he just sort of assembled it. He certainly didn't direct most of it. So that's the argument. But the deciding factor for me is the many, many times in interviews that Allen has said that his first film was Take the Money and Run. So Take the Money and Run being his first film is a club I'm happy to be a part of. San Quentin was made much more famous by Johnny Cash, who recorded a live album there, also released in 1969. Allen shot scenes there in late 68, and Johnny Cash visited in February of 69. So in just a few months, the prison hosted both Woody Allen and Johnny Cash.
I'm gonna rob a bank.
Oh no, Virgil, not again.
Yes.
And finally, the wrong bank film that's shown to the bank robbers is called Trout Fishing in Quebec. The film is credited as a Rollins and Joffe production, just like most of Allen's films. Rollins and Joffe were, of course, Allen's managers.
10 a.m. What you're about to see are films of the Union Fidelity Bank. We're gonna see them just once. Then to destroy the evidence, we're gonna eat the film. It'll be buffet style. You can just help yourself, take plates. There's potato salad over there, and my wife made coffee. These films could save your lives.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Woody Allen Pages podcast and making it to the end. The end bit is where I talk about ways to support the website and the podcast, and this week I really want to highlight the books. It feels like the books have been doing really well and that people are loving them. They are three volumes going through every Woody Allen film up to A Rainy Day in New York. I go through a lot of what's in the book in the podcast, but there is so much more. There's quotes from thousands of people who have worked with Allen over the years, plus I break down every film minute by minute. Every location that we know, every music cue, every cameo, every obscure book reference, and even every car model that I could find. It is intensely nerdy. They are available digitally and on paperback through Amazon. If you have a Kindle Unlimited, you can just go and read it. Links are in the description. And there's other ways to support me too, like the Patreon or the tipping service Buy Me a Coffee. There's also a bit of merch with the podcast artwork. All the links are in the description. And don't forget, leave me a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts as well. It really helps for this podcast to be discovered. You can also find all the links to the website with 10 years of great content, all the social media links, and ways to get in touch with me. Next week, it's time for some fun with one of Woody Allen's biggest ensembles.
That looks to me like two elephants making love to a men's glee club.